Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, we'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, Radio Havana Cuba, and Russia's Sputnik Radio. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Donald Trump spent 2 days visiting India with Prime Minister Modi to make trade and defense deals. The trade deals were not finalized and protesters were kept at bay. U.S.-India relations are increasingly important as U.S.-China conflicts expand. Meanwhile, there were deadly riots in Delhi over Modi's new citizenship law, which many see as anti-Muslim. The coronavirus is ever-expanding, causing disruption in Europe, especially Italy. A review of the countries where it is already altering public life. The legendary carnival in Rio has incorporated many political statements against the right-wing populist government of Bolsonaro. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
We're now to India, day 2 of Donald Trump's visit there, during which the focus switched from pomp and pageantry to trade and defense. Following talks with Prime Minister Narendra Modi in Delhi, Trump said that they had made progress on what he called a comprehensive trade deal. No details were revealed, but the two men seemed keen to put the Trump-Modi chemistry on show.
At this welcome reception, size did matter. Indian leaders made sure that the U.S. president would be greeted with a lavish extravaganza and mighty words.
This relationship is the most important partnership of the 21st century.
Throughout the meeting, the tone between the two leaders was friendly, even loving.
We're at a point where our relationship is so special with India. It has never been as good as it is right now, and I think that's because the two leaders of each country, really, we feel very strongly about each other.
While the president and the prime minister seemed at ease with each other, the outcome of the talks was meager. Both expressed optimism at the prospect of a future trade deal and left it at that. From the three services. The meeting was overshadowed by violence that erupted in another part of Delhi over a new citizenship law claiming several casualties. Those opposed to the law believe it discriminates against India's Muslim citizens. The timing of the clashes is an embarrassment for the Indian Prime Minister, eager to show a polished picture of his nation. Protesters also showed up to object to Trump's visit. Their message to the U.S. leader was clear.
Narendra Modi might bow down in front of you, but the Indian people, the Indian general masses of India, they are not going to say that you are welcome. India says, go back, Trump, you are not our guest.
The Trumps, unaffected by the criticism, visited tourist sites between their official engagements. The president will leave India with many picturesque memories. The dealmaker, however, will go home without a trade deal in his pocket.
And for more tonight, I'm joined by Ankit Panda, a senior editor at The Diplomat and an award-winning writer on geopolitics in the Asia-Pacific region. His upcoming book is called Kim Jong-un and the Bomb, Survival and Deterrence in North Korea. That book due out this summer. He joins us tonight from New York. It's good to have you on the show, Ankit. The U.S. president, we know that he likes to brag about the close personal relationships that he has with other leaders, such as North Korea's leader. Now it's the Indian prime minister. How much Kim Jong-un would you say there is in Narendra Modi?
Well, certainly I think President Trump is looking to get optics out of this trip that he hopes will be useful later this year in the elections in the United States, making himself appear like a statesman overseas after a acrimonious impeachment trial that he successfully survived. So certainly I think that's been a big part of the trip to India. If we look at the president's Twitter page, for example, he has been sharing video from this trip showing himself being surrounded by adoring masses in India. So certainly I think the optics are a very big part of that here. And Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, I think, has also played his hand quite well in making the U.S. president feel quite welcome in India.
And what about the elephant in the room here? I'm talking about China. What role did the rivalry between the U.S. and China, what role did it play in Trump's visit to India?
Well, I think the important thing to take away is that we see a lot of continuity in the U.S.-India relationship. This relationship for about 20 years has been converging strategically because India and the United States see eye to eye on a lot of things in the Asia Pacific, even if they don't exactly agree on the details concerning China, particularly the nature of the China threat. The United States sees a rising India as inherently positive for its own interests in the Asia Pacific as a counterweight to China. And India, meanwhile, sees the U.S. as an important source of support as it seeks to rise on its own terms. And certainly, I think we've seen that make the transition from the Obama administration to the Trump administration, and also from India's previous government under Manmohan Singh and the Congress Party into the age of Narendra Modi, even as the two sides do have different over issues, including trade, which has certainly become a major issue under Trump.
Yeah, and keeping that in mind, you know, Donald Trump, he left India today with no new trade deal to bring home with him. Is the U.S.-India military alliance that you're talking about, is it strong enough, is it important enough to overcome the significant trade disagreements between the two countries?
Well, so notably, the two countries are not formally allies. The Indians are actually quite averse to using that term to describe their relationship with any country. But what Modi did say during the visit is that the relationship has been elevated to what they're calling a comprehensive global strategic partnership. That sounds like a lot of adjectives, but basically the U.S.-India relationship continues on an upward trend. Importantly, in the last few years, the two sides have concluded a variety of important military agreements that are allowing them to collaborate more closely than ever in things like military exercises, information sharing, all things that I think are going to manifest in important ways in the coming years and decades in the Asia Pacific. We can express the U.S. Navy and the Indian Navy collaborating more in the Indo-Pacific region in the next few years.
Ankit Panda, a senior editor at The Diplomat.
Indian medical officials say the death toll from riots in the capital, Delhi, has risen to 18. The violence erupted early this week between thousands protesting for and against a new citizenship law. Critics say the legislation introduced by the Hindu nationalist-led government is biased against Muslims.
Well, the new strain of the coronavirus, which is known as COVID-19, it first emerged in the Chinese city of Wuhan back in December. To date, the virus has claimed almost 3,000 lives. China still has the highest number of reported cases, more than 77,000. It is followed by South Korea, Italy, Japan, and Iran. 41 other countries or territories around the world have also reported cases. Now, that brings the global total to more than 81,000. And this is what has happened just in the last 24 hours. South Korea has reported its biggest one-day jump in infections. Brazil has confirmed Latin America's first case. And here in Europe, Italy remains the front line in the struggle to contain the outbreak. That outbreak has now claimed 12 lives there. France tonight reporting its first fatality. And what about travel? International flights to affected areas, they have been cut back or canceled. Here's a closer look now at how countries around the world are fighting to ward off a pandemic.
The coronavirus is increasing its presence far beyond China's borders. It ranges from cruise ships in Japan to Tehran's public transport. It's also having an effect on countries where it has not yet emerged. Ireland has postponed a major international rugby game with Italy as a precaution. Italy is the country most affected by the virus in Europe. Despite these concerns, health authorities in Europe say there's no reason to panic about the coronavirus there.
We take the virus and the situation very seriously. At the same time, we should also remember that 4 out of 5 patients have mild symptoms and recover.
11 towns in northern Italy where the virus has been diagnosed remain under lockdown. Military police are staffing roadblocks, allowing only authorised personnel access. Nearly 50,000 people have been placed under effective quarantine there.
Now, the Rio Carnival is often associated with flamboyant floats, feathers and fun, but this year it's taken on an unusually political tone. Many floats have taken aim at the right-wing populist government of Jair Bolsonaro, who has divided the country with attacks on causes close to the heart of the Rio Carnival.
The highlight of this year's controversial carnival in Rio: Jesus on the cross in the form of a young black man from a favela, a poor neighborhood riddled with bullet holes. The Manguila Samba School wants the world to know today Jesus would be one of them.
He would be born in the Manguila favela. He would be black and he would definitely be killed by Rio's police force.
Their message was directed at the Brazilian government. Jesus is a gay man, an indigenous person, or as a woman. Minorities which feel threatened by Jair Bolsonaro's government.
I represent the women of the world who are attacked and murdered.
Even before the festival got underway, conservative Christian groups had already protested against the parade. This year's carnival was the most political in years, taking aim at corruption, racism, environmental destruction, and the murder of indigenous people.
Here we can say what we want, and this is our way of protesting.
As always, it's a protest contained in a competition which consists of colour, contours, and plenty of fantasy.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com. Deutsche Welle offers many special programs in English, which you can find at dw.com. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. At the United Nations Human Rights Council, the Cuban foreign minister denounced the intensification of the U.S. blockade on the island, saying it is an attempted genocide. The British newspaper The Guardian critiqued Trump and Pompeo's attacks on the Cuban medical collaboration that offers free health care to impoverished communities around the world. The United Nations Security Council has renewed the call for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Opening arguments were heard in the extradition trial of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, while protests were ongoing outside. On the second day of the hearing, his lawyers reported that Julian was mistreated when he was returned to prison after the first day, including confiscating his case files. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez denounced the intensification of the U.S. blockade and its impact on the Cuban people at the 43rd session of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. He declared that the economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed by Washington for six decades constitutes an act of genocide, according to the 1948 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, and a flagrant, massive, and systematic violation of the human rights of an entire people. Rodriguez reminded the international community that the blockade applied by successive U.S. administrations and strengthened by the current one is based on the declared purpose of conquering the inhabitants of Cuba with hunger and desperation.
The British newspaper The Guardian denounced the threats made by U.S. President Donald Trump against the Cuban medical collaboration and the tightening of the siege against Cuban humanitarian missions, which have helped some of the most impoverished communities in the world. The publication exposes Washington's unfounded accusations that Havana uses doctors to undermine democracy in the nations involved and of exploiting personnel sent on missions. The newspaper reports that the false claims are spearheaded by U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who described the deployment of Cuban doctors in countries from Venezuela to Brazil and Ecuador as a sinister interference in their affairs, and congratulated countries such as Bolivia that have expelled them. The article contrasts Pompeo's view with that of John Kirk, an academic of Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, who interviewed several hundred Cuban doctors and even lived with some of them for a while. The newspaper says the U.S. campaign against Cuban doctors has intensified amid recent political changes in Latin America, where left-hand governments have been replaced by right-wing regimes closely aligned with Washington.
The United Nations Security Council has renewed the call for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, weeks after the United States unveiled a so-called peace plan that runs counter to such a solution and to the international law. All 15 Security Council's member states approved a Belgium-drafted statement that urged all parties to adhere to the two-state bid. Council members reiterated their support for negotiated two-state solution, recalling previous relevant UN resolutions and in accordance with international law, the statement read. Security Council resolutions have in the past called for the two-state resolution based on the 1967 boundaries. A Security Council resolution of December 2016 declared settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem to be a flagrant violation under international law and a major obstacle to the achievement of the two-state solution.
Opening arguments were made on the first day of the U.S. extradition hearing of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, with the prosecution claiming his leaks risked lives, while the defense argued that his case was politically motivated. Monday's hearing lasted 6 hours and will continue through this week. The journalist supporters amazed outside Woolwich Crown Court, loudly chanting, holding "Free Assange" signs. Speaking to the gathered media, Assange's father, John Chipton, condemned what he called the ceaseless malice directed at his son by the United States and the United Kingdom. He cited a determination by UN Special Rapporteur on torture, Niels Masser, who said that Assange had been subjected to prolonged psychological torture. To bolster the argument against extradition, attorney Fitzgerald referred to former U.S. President Barack Obama's decision to commute the sentence of fellow whistleblower Chelsea Manning and a 2013 decision not to prosecute Assange, made on the grounds that the U.S. would also need to prosecute every newspaper that reported his revelations of war crimes committed by the United States. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's lawyers said on Tuesday that their client was mistreated in prison after he left the extradition hearing at the WikiLeaks Crown Court in London. Assange was handcuffed 11 times, stripped naked twice, and had his case files confiscated, his lawyer Edward Fitzgerald said. The case files, which the prisoner was reading in court on Monday, were confiscated by the guards when he returned to prison later. That same night, he was placed in 5 cells, he added.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's web stream worked well this week at their website, radiohc.cu, while their podcast links did not. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report, or could make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Almost all of the funding this freely distributed program receives is from individual listener donations. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support it. Through PayPal, you can create a monthly subscription to help cover my expenses. We will conclude with Russia's Sputnik Radio. On his program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi spoke with UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Melzer, about the persecution of Julian Assange. He discusses the threat that Assange's persecution poses to press freedom, why the mainstream media is slowly starting to support the WikiLeaks founder, the allegations Assange faced in Sweden, and Swedish complicity with CIA renditions during the Gulf War. Russia's Sputnik Radio.
The world's most famous publisher and arguably the entire freedom of the press to reveal war crimes is on trial today at a London court, just 12 miles from this studio. After years of alleged UK torture and disinformation, even so-called mainstream news outlets that have attacked this channel and been responsible for an arguable attack on truth since 9/11 and before are getting worried about this week's alleged UK persecution of Julian Assange of WikiLeaks.
Well, if you watched a lot of the coverage of this story today on television, you likely came away with the understanding that Julian Assange is some kind of Russian spy who's in trouble tonight because he stole classified documents from the U.S. government. That is not true. It's factually incorrect. Saying so is not a defense of Assange. We're not here to promote him or excuse any number of things he said over the years that we disagree with quite a lot. But just so it's clear, whatever his sins, Assange did not steal documents from the United States government. He did not hack the DNC servers. He didn't break into John Podesta's Gmail account. There is no proof that he is working for the Russian government or ever has worked for the Russian government. Assange has never been charged with any of that and wasn't today, no matter what they tell you.
Grudging defenses of Assange by outlets like Rupert Murdoch's Fox News, the state-mandated BBC, and former WikiLeaks partners, The Guardian, New York Times, among others, are perhaps emerging because they realize they could all soon find themselves in court for merely reporting on the crimes of NATO countries. Well, I'm joined now by the United Nations, Nils Melzer. Special Rapporteur, welcome back to Going Underground.
Today, what we're seeing is really that the mainstream press starts to realize, through publications in alternative media, that they probably got it wrong. And so they get more interested in discovering the truth about the story.
Less face-saving and more, they know that if Assange is convicted, the next people could be them.
Well, we do have indicators of that, and perhaps they start to, as we say, smell the coffee. After the raids on the ABC headquarters in Australia and after Glenn Greenwald was arrested in Brazil and is being accused, you know, according to the same kind of playbook that we see playing out with Assange. So perhaps they start, and or also public funds being cut from mainstream broadcasters, perhaps they start realizing that they really did first come for Assange, then for Greenwald, and now they may be coming for the BBC.
Well, Amnesty International, they've refused to make him a prisoner of conscience. Why do you think there are still other NGOs who refuse to take on board the Julian Assange cause?
I think I have, you know, I very much support Amnesty International when they try to protect people by declaring them prisoners of conscience. But when they use their worldwide influence to exclude individuals from that category, I think then it becomes very problematic, especially when we're talking about a journalist who has been exposing grave violations of human rights and who is prosecuted precisely because he has exposed violations of human rights. Julian Assange is not a whistleblower. He did not leak information.
It was just leaked. The publisher.
He was leaked to him.
You don't think this anymore has anything to do with what you call fabricated rape allegations? In fact, you believe those allegations could be linked to the Afghan war logs, revelations of Anglo-American NATO troops in Afghanistan.
Yes, well, I'm not in a position to, you know, confirm or deny whether there has been some kind of a sexual offense at some point between the women and Julian Assange. All I can say, I've seen the original Swedish police documents where the women are not claiming to have been raped, but you can see even the woman sitting in the police station, sending a text message to a friend saying, I don't want to accuse Assange of anything. I just want him to take an HIV test, but the police wants to get their hands on them, on him. So, I mean, who would write a message like that? Not a raped woman. Then we see a consecutive series of grave violations of due process in the Swedish case. And all of this happens within a month of the publication of the Afghan leaks. So where the U.S. has asked their allies to initiate prosecutions against Assange wherever possible. The choreography of this, how it plays out, and how Sweden actually at no stage in the proceedings really tries to protect the women's interests, refuses to question Assange when he is still in Sweden and offers and actually demands to be questioned. But the day he leaves Sweden and he receives written permission by the prosecutor to leave Sweden, they issue an arrest warrant against him for trying to evade justice. And as soon as you scratch the surface a bit of this case, you realize there is nothing to back it up.
Okay, you also discovered a trail that led to Swedish Justice Minister Thomas Bodström, the former Justice Minister, who you claim effectively supervised a kind of rendition torture, perhaps documented by WikiLeaks, of the kind documented by WikiLeaks.
Well, he was the Justice Minister when Sweden and the security police of Sweden kidnapped two people that were registered asylum seekers in Stockholm and handed them over to CIA without any due process, and they were immediately ill-treated on the airport territory and then flown to Egypt, where they were tortured and detained arbitrarily. Of these two people, we know because they survived. Both of them filed complaints with the United Nations, and Sweden was obliged to pay them, I think, each of them about $500,000 in compensation.
Chelsea Manning, who was let out early by President Obama, a source for WikiLeaks, has been virtually bankrupted, so they say, by the United States, for refusing to testify against Julian Assange. So UK authorities here, are they basically deciding on whether a show trial should go ahead?
Absolutely, yes. I think this is not, well, it's about whether this show trial should go ahead, because there's not going to be nothing else than a show trial in the US. There's no chance he's going to get a fair trial. It's not just about Julian Assange. This really is a battle over press freedom, over the rule of law, over the future, I would say even of democracy, because democracy, which means that the people control governmental power, this cannot exist with secrecy. Yeah? You deprive the public of their right to know, and you deprive them of the tools to control the government.
Special Rapporteur, thank you.
Thank you.
That interview was from Afshin Ratansi's program called Going Underground, heard on Sputnik Radio 3 times a week, the current name for The Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You could use a shortwave radio at home. It's simpler than you might think, except for the interference that electronic devices make. If you use the internet, listening globally is easier and noise-free. See the links at this program's website. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 23rd year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.